Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. The race for a vaccine against the novel coronavirus and COVID-19 is on. We get almost daily updates about one company or another's trials for safety and efficacy. Many experts, though, say that the race for a vaccine will take much longer than we hope, well into next year. In spite of these efforts, news reports suggest that 25% of Americans surveyed would decline an immunization against COVID-19, in spite of the fact that over the last 6 months it's upended all of our lives and caused 200,000 American deaths. My guest today, Jonathan Berman, has studied the phenomenon of anti-vaxxers, those who are labeled as vaccine hesitant or who decline vaccinations for themselves or their children altogether. Vaccine science is unequivocally one of the greatest success stories of the last century of medical science, saving hundreds of millions of lives and sparing countless millions more morbidity like paralysis, neurologic damage, respiratory difficulty, scarring, and more. The benefits of vaccines greatly outweigh the risks, and yet, anti-vaccination campaigns are still strong in an era of amplified social media and abundant conspiracy theories. As Berman points out, vaccine skepticism is nothing new. And I should point out that no credible scientist or physician believes that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine is in any way linked to the rise of autism over the last 2 decades, despite much misinformation to the contrary. Jonathan Berman is an assistant professor of basic science at New York Institute of Technology College of Osteopathic Medicine, based at the new Jonesboro, Arkansas campus. His new book is Anti-Vaxxers: How to Challenge a Misinformed Movement, and it's just out from MIT Press. Jonathan Berman is my guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. Dr. Jonathan Berman, welcome to Medical Monday. Your book, Anti-Vaxxers, How to Challenge a Misinformed Movement, what interested me from the get-go is that this is not really a new problem. There have been people against vaccination since the very beginning of the science. Tell us a little bit about some of the history.
Yeah, that was something that was surprising to me. A lot of the time when people talk about vaccination and anti-vaxxers, they start the story in 1998 with Andrew Wakefield and his paper that seemed to indicate that there might be a relationship between vaccination and autism. And it turns out that as soon as the first vaccination occurred, there was opposition to it pretty much immediately. And I go back a little bit further even than Jenner. There was a farmer named Benjamin Jesty, and he made this observation, which was that milkmaids never seemed to get smallpox, and they would get something called cowpox, which produced similar pustules to smallpox, and it would produce them on cow's udders, and it would be transferred to milkmaids, and they would get it too. And the course of cowpox was very rarely fatal, and smallpox had something like a 10% mortality rate back then. So he, in the middle of a smallpox outbreak, took a knitting needle, a cow, and his wife, and he did what anyone would do, which is he burst a pustule and then used that pus to scratch his wife. And she developed an infection at the wound site, and people thought he was not all there. And so that was how the first anti-vaxxers came about. Then when people started systematically studying vaccination, like Jenner did, there was almost immediate opposition then, too, for, I think, a few reasons. One was that people saw that as blurring the line between human and animal, between cows and humans. Another was that at the time, there wasn't as strong a monopoly on medical treatment as science has now. So people doing things like hydropathy or folk remedies were seen.
Yeah, remind us, what is hydropathy?
The treatment of disease with water.
Yeah, not so effective.
If your disease is dehydration, it's very effective.
Right.
So people wanted to challenge this monopoly that science had on the treatment of disease. And at the time, even the what we would call real physicians weren't that great. So there was almost immediate opposition. And then it took almost another 50 years before vaccination was accepted to the point where it was going to be made mandatory. And that's when real organized opposition started to vaccination. There were enormous marches with almost 100,000 people. There were riots in Montreal and Rio de Janeiro. And throughout the 20th century, there was anti-vaccine activity as well. So people talk about it sometimes like it started in 1998, but it's really been this continuous thing. As long as there's been vaccination, there's been anti-vaxxers.
Yeah, and that was really what was so informative about the book. But also, what do you attribute the mainstream acceptance? The vaccination rates, for example, in the United States went up well into the high 90th percentile. I mean, there have always been exceptions to getting, you know, full compliance, and there's always been reasons and, of course, state and local, well, state-level exemptions, which you go into some detail about. But was it the war efforts? What was it? It was a little bit of the acceptance and mainstreaming of the medical profession that led to more credibility, was it not?
Yeah, that was a big part of it. I think professionalization of medicine played a big role. So making medicine not into just a hobby, but someone's entire career, and having a governing body and standards of care played a big role. And at a certain point, it became very possible to make an extremely strong argument for vaccination, which was that there used to be smallpox, there were records, and then once people started vaccinating, smallpox went away. And as other vaccines were developed, and as sort of the methods of trials and studies were developed and placebo controls, it became more and more clear that vaccination was an effective method of preventing disease. I think, though, that people are really making kind of a complex judgment of risk. So I think you'd probably agree, there's no medical treatment with zero risk.
Yeah? None that I know of.
None that you know of. So people see that there's some risk to vaccination, and the job of medical professionals and scientists is to sell them on the benefits, and that the benefits outweigh the risk. And most of the time, they've been effective at that. And there have been other times where they've been less effective. After accidents and mistakes, there was an incident in the 50s with improperly inactivated polio vaccine that resulted in some cases of paralysis. And when those things become very noticeable and popular in media, that can lead to distrust.
So in the book, you show, you have a chart about the major drop-off in smallpox due to vaccination. And in fact, it's the only disease that's been entirely eradicated and only exists really in laboratories in Russia, former Soviet Union, and the United States. But you did mention the mishap in the early days of the polio vaccination. But for the most part, people who have a memory of childhood polio or infantile paralysis due to polio remember it so strongly, and fearful summers, you know, kind of like now with COVID-19, that there was widespread adoption of the two different kinds of polio vaccine. And so there's never really been, you point out, there's nothing in medicine that is without risk, but the risk to benefit ratio with immunizations is so strongly in favor of the benefits over the risk. And of course, there are some people who have adverse reactions, and there are always posited reactions. Let's take, for example, one that you mentioned briefly, which was there was a flu shot in the mid to late 70s that seemed to result in a cluster of an illness called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a peripheral neuropathy that seems to be reactive to some sort of stimulant. And that never even really borne out, although many people still tie the two together.
Yeah, so the most recent thing I've read seemed to indicate that the most recent analysis was that it elevated the absolute risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome to about 1 in 100,000. Out of millions of people vaccinated, something like 40 people had cases, and that seemed to be elevated again above the baseline in the population. But it's true that people will still, to this day, express concerns about GBS in relation to totally unrelated vaccines that work in different ways. So part of the story of anti-vaxxers is that risk assessment kind of falling out of proportion, through information that's not entirely correct, but mostly I think through people starting from an emotional reaction or starting from a place of fear or concern and then looking for information that will support those concerns or support their beliefs, rather than the scientific way of looking at things, which is to start with a question and then look for information that will answer that question.
Yeah, and let's look at a few of those specific instances. I just want to reintroduce you. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Jonathan Berman, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Basic Sciences at New York Institute of Technology College of Osteopathic Medicine. He's actually based in Jonesboro, Arkansas. He has a new book called Anti-Vaxxers: How to Challenge a Misinformed Movement. And the book goes in some detail, looking at the history of vaccination and anti-vaccination. And one of the issues that comes up is a chemical or an additive to vaccines that was used for decades called thimerosal. And thimerosal was used essentially to help suspend the vaccines and preserve them so that they could be used in multi-dose vials. And one of the issues is that there's a molecular form of mercury in thimerosal, a very trace amount that seems to cause no harm over millions and millions of doses of different kinds of vaccines. And yet, anti-vaxxers have centered on that molecule as particularly dangerous. Tell us a little bit about thimerosal.
So that's what you said is true. Thimerosal is a preservative that was used in multi-dose vials of vaccines. The reason for that is that you can sterilize a vaccine at the manufacturing point, and then you want to be able to distribute it in a form where it can be used for multiple patients. So a vial with maybe 10 milliliters in it, and a dose might be half a milliliter, so you can use it for 20 people, for example. Otherwise, you would be removing some and then inserting another needle into the vial, potentially introducing bacteria. So thimerosal was used for decades, since I think 1930s, and there was a concern raised that some people thought that the mercury in thimerosal might be causing neurological symptoms. And you can kind of understand why someone might think that. Mercury can cause neurological symptoms. It can bioaccumulate and end up in food chains and in fish and cause heavy metal poisoning. So people extrapolated that to, well, maybe we should be concerned about thimerosal, even though it has this track record going back decades. Let's take a look at it. And the FDA took a look at it, and they didn't find any real reason to be concerned about it, but out of an abundance of caution, they said, well, let's take thimerosal out of the routine childhood vaccination schedule wherever possible. And that was in the late 90s. And so it was removed from the routine childhood vaccination schedule, except for one small dose in a particular formulation of a flu vaccine, which I think is no longer used. And what happened was that in unrelated development, claims were made that the MMR vaccine, which did not contain thimerosal, was causing increases in cases of autism, or what they consider to be a novel kind of regressive autism, which has actually never been shown to exist. So,
Let's remind people that MMR stands for measles, mumps, and rubella. It's a combined vaccine against those three different types of infectious viral diseases.
yes. So people seem to confuse those two claims, that there might be neurological symptoms from thimerosal, and that MMR, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine might be causing autism. And so people started claiming that thimerosal in vaccines was causing autism. And if it were the case that that were true, then you would have expected that once it was removed from the normal childhood vaccination schedule, that autism diagnosis rates would decline because, well, now the thimerosal is no longer being used in vaccines. In actuality, the opposite occurred, as we continue to see an increase in diagnosis rates of autism. And the most likely explanation for that is an increase in awareness of autism spectrum disorder and increase in diagnosis and increase in research into autism spectrum disorder, as well as changes to the way the federal government handles benefits related to autism spectrum disorder that sort of incentivized people to seek a diagnosis where they might not have before.
And so, as you just stated, the cases of autism actually went up, even though thimerosal was essentially removed entirely from the vaccine supply. And yet, the removal, the CDC decision to recommend removing thimerosal from the vaccine supply actually seem to spark more conspiracy theory, because after all, if it wasn't dangerous, why would it be recommended to be removed? So all it did was, in a sense, trying to do something to, I guess, quiet down the claims against immunizations or vaccinations, wound up just perpetuating, I think, more conspiracy theories.
Yeah, and I think that kind of gets to the point of, it's not necessarily that any of the individual claims that anti-vaxxers make have an especially great amount of merit. And addressing these claims just by telling people, you're wrong, here's what the truth is, seems not to work. I call that the information deficit model of science communication, where I know something, you don't know something, and I'm going to jam it into your skull by telling you. What does seem to be more effective is kind of meeting people where they are, seeing, well, what do you believe? Why do you believe it? And then addressing the underlying concerns. The concern wasn't thimerosal. The concern was people were afraid of vaccination for other reasons. So addressing thimerosal didn't address the underlying concern.
Now, you have a chapter in here about social media, fake news, and the spread of information. And I wonder for your take, about your take on how social media can really amplify conspiracy theories or, you know, misattributable science.
So that's true. In studies of how information spreads on social media, fake news stories, stories that aren't true, spread faster than true news stories. And there are a few possibilities for why that is. I think the most likely is that people are looking for novelty. And a true news story, or a news story that's reputable at least, that's reported on the website of a major broadcasting company or publication, is something you can find in a major broadcasting company or publication. But people don't go to Twitter or Facebook for that. They go to Twitter or Facebook to find new things, novelty. So the story that seems to contradict what people call mainstream publications are the ones people feel are the juiciest, or the ones they want to click share on. The other factor I think is important is group polarization, which is once you're in a group online that is spreading misinformation, or really any kind of group with outside of the mainstream views, people tend to become more committed to those groups over time, either because more extreme statements and viewpoints are rewarded by other group members, or because the more moderate influences get driven out by the more extreme elements over time.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Jonathan Berman, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Basic Sciences at New York Institute of Technology, College of Osteopathic Medicine in Jonesboro, Arkansas. He's author of the new book, Anti-Vaxxers, How to Challenge a Misinformed Movement, which is just out from the MIT Press. And Jonathan Berman, I was wondering how you got interested in the topic of vaccines. As I understand, you are a basic scientist, research renal physiology or sodium ion channels. How did you come to get interested in this broader scientific communication question and the issue of vaccination in particular?
So that's true. I'm not a vaccinologist. I was working on another, what I would consider, science communication project, which was the March for Science in 2017. I was one of the national co-chairs of the March for Science, and I would encounter people who had what I thought was a really peculiar behavior. In one breath, they would say, we need to listen to scientists when it comes to global climate change. And then in the same breath, they would repeat these anti-vaccine tropes. And that was one class of person I would run into. And it was really strange to me. I was struggling to understand that contradiction. So I kept kind of mulling it over, and eventually my reading on the topic and research into it was enough notes to make into a book proposal.
So that's interesting, the contrast between people who believe in science when it comes to climate change, which there are certainly a healthy array of skeptics about, although it seems fewer and fewer, but certainly, you know, many that are out there, and yet not willing to necessarily believe the science when it comes to things like vaccines. And so I suppose there are, the converse is probably true. People who believe in vaccines or vaccinate their children, but then don't believe the science on climate change. So it's a sort of a selective intentionality, I guess, if you will.
Yeah, that I agree. And I think that's something that is characteristic of science denial. There was a 2015 Pew study that looked at the beliefs of non-scientists and scientists on a variety of issues, genetically modified foods, vaccination, climate change. And there is a big gap on these individual areas of inquiry, these topics. But by and large, 80-90% of people really love science. They're pro-science. If you ask them, do you believe, trust science, they'll say yes. And then on these individual topics, they will have a disagreement with the scientific consensus. So that's part of why I think it's not the topic, and it's not a distrust of science, although I think there is a misunderstanding of science involved, but it's that people arrive at their beliefs through mechanisms other than, or different from the way that scientists do, and that leads people down rabbit holes toward beliefs that are different from those of the scientific consensus.
So, Jonathan, I have to ask you, what do you make of these news stories that are, you know, fairly recent, or, you know, probably over the last 4 to 6 months, of if and when we get a coronavirus vaccine, that anywhere, depending on who or what you read, 20-30% of people wouldn't even accept it or take the vaccine? I mean, do you think that it'll actually be that high, or is that just sort of polling noise?
So, 2 points. The first is we don't need everyone to get a vaccine, in part because a lot of people are already immune through the almost unchecked spread of the virus. And we don't need to totally eliminate all spread. We need to get R less than 1. We need to get the number of average new cases from every case to be less than 1. And then the disease will taper off. And so the exact fraction of the population we need to vaccinate is going to depend on the efficacy of the vaccine or vaccines that are approved. Most likely the vaccination story for coronavirus is going to be a multi-part story with multiple vaccines. I think, though, that the number will be higher than that. And that's because in the case of other vaccines where people have doubts, and when they fill out surveys, they'll say, I don't trust the safety of the measles vaccine. They still tend to get vaccinated. There is a gap between their assessment of the risk and their behavior. So really, people's risk assessment is a lot more complicated than just identifying vaccines as a risk. They're also, they have other factors in their decision making that tend to lead them to get vaccinated, even if they don't completely trust the vaccine.
Interesting. Well, one more question for you, which is kind of the thesis of your book. So when you encounter someone who, say, doesn't vaccinate their children or doesn't believe in it or expresses what we call vaccine skepticism, your point, I think, and you've articulated this a little bit, which is we can't just inundate them with logic and facts, but you sort of advocate a more holistic view. How would you conclude in terms of your recommendations on whether or not people should accept vaccinations?
So changing someone's mind is really hard because you have to convince them to change their own mind. And people are reluctant to do that a lot of the time, and it's a risk, changing your mind or accepting new ideas. So if you want to have that conversation with someone, you have to make it a safe for them to change their mind or come to a different conclusion than they've come to before. A lot of anti-vaxxers or dedicated anti-vaxxers have other anti-vaxxers in their social support network who would cut them out, or are in circumstances that make it difficult for them to express a different view. So we want to be good friends and neighbors and show them that other people in their communities are vaccinating and that it's an important part of being a community member and being a contributor to the general welfare.
Well, it's well put. The name of the book is Anti-Vaxxers, How to Challenge a Misinformed Movement. And it's by my guest today, Dr. Jonathan Berman, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Basic Sciences at New York Institute of Technology, College of Osteopathic Medicine in Jonesboro, Arkansas. Jonathan Berman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.